Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, October 15, 2020. South Sudan's economic crisis deepens with foreign exchange rate against South Sudan pounds increasing.
After thorough deliberation, the cabinet decided to appeal to those business people and those traders who have closed their shops to open them for the public.
And six people are killed in Sudan's Red Sea state as protests continued Wednesday.
Sawakin port has been affected so much during these clashes, which led to the killing of six individuals. Eight injured people have been taken to Sawakin Hospital, and eight others are currently getting treatment at Port Sudan Teaching Hospital.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's transitional government of national unity is asking traders to remain calm after the government announced last week it will change the country's currency. The announcement caused panic and local currency lost its value against the US dollar, forcing commodity prices to increase. South Sudan's information minister says the government's announcement to change the local currency was taken out of context. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
The government's announcement sent shockwaves through markets, especially on the foreign exchange market. On Friday, the dollar traded for 500 South Sudanese pounds. On Monday and Tuesday, the dollar was trading for 700 South Sudanese pounds, forcing commodity prices to rise as traders wondered what would happen to their money when a new currency is introduced. Kamis Opoka, a resident of the border town of Numili, says people living and working on the border with Uganda are especially worried about the change in currency.
Today, there's not any business which they bring those fresh items from the other side of Uganda. They refuse to bring the food today because of the rate. Even the other shop, they are not open. Unless when you go to the shop and then they ask you Uganda money. Today at morning time, I went to buy something in the shop, the sugar, but the owner of that shop told me that now sugar I cannot sell because now when I sell the price, you cannot afford. And even he closed the shop and then he went away.
President Salva Kiir convened an extraordinary Council of Ministers meeting over the economic crisis on Wednesday. Immediately after the meeting, Information Minister and Government Spokesman Michael McQuay told reporters the government wants traders to remain calm.
After thorough deliberation, the cabinet decided to appeal to those business people and those traders who have closed their shops to open them for the public. Because all those who have closed the shops, of course, are in a way adding more to what is already there.
McQuay says the government's decision to change the local currency was misunderstood by the public. Instead of encouraging people to deposit their South Sudanese pounds in the bank, it wound up having the opposite effect. People rushed to get their hands on the U.S. dollars of any amount. McQuay says the cabinet has tasked Trade and Industry Minister Kwal Athian Mawien to urgently meet the business owners across the country to address the matter.
For the clarification of this decision and the former resolution, the Minister of Trade and Industry will be meeting with all the communities, all the business communities that are operating here in South Sudan. Being indigenous or foreign, all these bodies will have to be met and explained to them. Meanwhile, they are expecting to open their shops tomorrow. Meanwhile, their shops are open. If they have any grievances, if there is anything, then it is these are the issues that we will discuss with the Minister of Trade and Industry.
Last Friday, the government formed a Cabinet Economic Committee to conduct a study on various government resolutions, including the production of a new currency as a way to improve the shrinking economy. Makwei says the panel will report back to the cabinet this Friday, after which the government will come up with measures to improve the economy. Dr. Abraham Kwalnyon, a professor of economics at the University of Juba, says the South Sudanese economy is rapidly deteriorating because it is primarily based on speculations rather than traditional best practices.
The issue of printing of the new currency was supposed to be taken for more scrutiny and analysis before it could be adopted as a government policy. The change of currency by itself should not bring any stability within a South Sudan economy.
Kwal says citizens have reasons to panic after hearing the government's plans to change the country's currency.
Let's say if you have 1 million South Sudanese pounds, and the new South Sudanese pound that is coming to market, they will say 1 million will be equal to 1,000 South Sudanese pounds. That means people are losing 3 digits. This is why people are panicking in the market.
South Sudan depends almost exclusively on oil revenues, which accounts for a little over 98% of its budget. Kwal says part of the reason the economy is suffering is low oil prices on the international market due to the coronavirus pandemic. He says the government overlooked other non-oil revenue for a long time, which has contributed to the ailing economy. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The chief of the UN World Food Programme in South Sudan says the Nobel Peace Prize awarded to his agency gives what he calls a new breath to hundreds of WFP employees and partners who are trying to deliver food aid to the hungry across the country. Matthew Hollingsworth says the award reminds the team that they are on the right track against the worsening food crisis in the country. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Nadia Andrew fled her home when conflict broke out in Juba in December 2013 and sought shelter at the UN Protection of Civilian or POC site in Juba. She says since she and her family entered the camp 7 years ago, they have relied on food from the WFP.
If it wasn't for WFP, I think there wouldn't have been meals or something to eat within the POC for all these years. So they've been together with us ever since that time until today.
Andrew says many people in the POCs, like her, are not certain there will be sustainable peace in South Sudan. She says the WFP should continue providing food assistance to the tens of thousands of IDPs they are helping in South Sudan. She notes that while amount of food rations has been cut in half in recent months,
they should continue with the great job they've been doing. And if possible, for the POCs here in Juba, the ratios have been reduced and the numbers is really increasing.
Sunday Stephen went to UN-run POC in 2014 and says she has been relying on WFP food rations ever since. She says she feels she does not have much choice with the way things are.
If you have to look around South Sudan, we are having a lot of people who are staying in our IDP camps. And due to the situation that forced them to go there, you can also see someone just migrating from his home place or her home place because of the situation. Maybe it could be general situation, food and security situation. So you can migrate to where WFP can help you because they're helping people with food. So me personally, I can say like WFP have done a lot to me, myself, and also to my entire family, because all of us are living in the POC. And without WFP support, so we cannot survive.
Matthew Hollingsworth, the WFP country director for South Sudan, says last week's announcement that the UN's food agency had won the Nobel Peace Prize causes excitement among staff and WFP partners. Hollingsworth says the award reminds WFP staff of the enormous efforts they have made in saving lives. He says the award comes with a new spirit of commitment.
Receiving the Nobel Peace Prize this year means that for, you know, the 1,200 plus staff that the World Food Programme have in South Sudan, that everybody has taken that as recognition that we're on the right track. That we're on the right track in clearly trying to end hunger in South Sudan, but we're also on the right track in terms of our support to link with other partners on helping to bring peace to this country, to bring longer-term stability to this country.
Musa Mahad, WFP's communications officer in South Sudan, says he was overjoyed to hear Friday's announcement.
The news of World Food Programme winning the Nobel Peace Prize found me in Mundri. And sincerely speaking, it is one of the best news that I have ever received for a very long time. Why? Because the effort that myself and my other colleagues working in Ayod, working in Bentiu, working in places like Duke Padet has been recognized. That means that we are doing work that is not only changing and saving people's lives, but also someone outside there is recognizing the effort that World Food Programme is doing.
Mahad says he finds it rewarding to work for the WFP, especially when he sees people's lives being transformed.
Providing food to people in this part of the country specifically gives you a sense of satisfaction, and the fact that the meal that the people receive here in most of the times is the only meal that people receive in their household, or it is the meal that they have like in other parts of the country.
Although a South Sudan peace agreement has been in place for some time, the complete formation of the unity government is still underway, and Hollingworth, they floods and intercommunal violence continues to uproot thousands of families from their homes, frustrating their efforts in the fight against hunger. The United Nations says as of September, half of the country experienced flooding, affecting some 800,000 people. 368,000 people were displaced by floods, according to the UN. Hollingworth says WFP is trying to reach more than 60% of people displaced by floods and intercommunal violence with food assistance over the next 6 months.
We will need to spend around $600 million. Not all of that is in logistics. Obviously, the vast majority of that is actually expenditure on food. But it also includes expenditure on getting families to be more productive themselves. So whether they're in rural communities or in urban communities, whether they are agriculturalists or whether they are livestock keepers.
6.5 million people across South Sudan were facing an emergency food crisis situation at the beginning of the year, which Hollingsworth says has worsened. He says in order to address the multiple crises, guns must go silent across the country so that humanitarian agency can focus on development. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
6 people were killed and 20 others injured in intercommunal violence in Suakin town of Sudan's Red Sea State on Wednesday. Eyewitnesses say the violence erupted Tuesday between supporters and opponents of Kassala State Governor Saleh Ammar, who was fired by Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok on Tuesday. Tension remain high in Kassala, Port Sudan, and other towns as the government tries to calm down the situation. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Eyewitnesses say the protests began Tuesday night in Kassala town after residents heard the Prime Minister Hamdok fired Governor Ammar. Shortly afterwards, residents of Port Sudan, Sawakin, and New Halfa began demonstrating in support of their tribe mates in Kassala. Red Sea State Governor Abdallah Shangrai declared a curfew in Port Sudan and Sawakin towns from 12 p.m. to 4 a.m. after tensions escalated in the area over the sacking of Governor Ammar. Speaking through a messaging app this morning from Port Sudan, local journalist Amin Sinanda confirmed at least 6 people were killed in Sawakin Port yesterday during clashes between Ammar's supporters and opponents. Sinada says about 20 others were injured and receiving treatment in Sawakin and Port Sudan hospitals.
Sawakin Port has been affected so much during these clashes, which led to the killing of 6 individuals. 8 injured people have been taken to Sawakin Hospital, and 8 others are currently getting treatment at Port Sudan Teaching Hospital.
Sinada says the demonstration continued this morning in the town and along the feeder road linking Khartoum with Port Sudan. He says there is a heavy deployment of joint security forces patrolling the town on Land Cruiser pickups. Sinada says the sound of gunfire could be heard across the town as authorities are trying to restrict the movement of civilians during the curfew hours.
Eyewitnesses are confirming that police in Port Sudan have used live bullets along with tear gas to disperse protesters at Shahinat checkpoint. We always depend on the final report from the hospital regarding the death toll and casualties. And up to this point, we have not gotten any update on today's development.
Life in the Port Sudan and other towns seems to be paralyzed as many shopping centers and public transportation is shut down, according to SINADA.
Public transport has been cut off and many shopping centers and markets remain closed. Movement is restricted between neighborhoods. So the imposed curfew has really affected people's lives in Sawakin and Port Sudan towns.
Protests by the Ahmad supporters coincided with demonstrations by the Bija community in the area against the just-signed Juba peace deal between the Sudanese government and armed groups. Bija community intellectuals say they were misrepresented during the peace negotiations. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus earlier this week, Muhammad Saleh, a member of the technical committee tasked with reconciling the peace agreement with the Sudanese constitution, says the Eastern Sudan track was one of the difficult tracks during negotiations because some voices were still demanding representation in the talks. He says that is why, when the deal was signed, they felt the Eastern track should be open up for more consultations.
So this window open will allow these non-participants to be part and parcel of the agreement. So there will be Eastern conference which should be held, and this conference we are hoping that it will accommodate those who were not part of Juba peace agreement.
Saleh says if the Juba peace agreement is implemented, the entire Eastern Sudan region will benefit from 30% of the national budget going into developmental projects. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, how are schools reopening in Southern Africa? That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
when you make a mistake, do you admit it or just move on and try not to do it again?
When I realize that I've done something wrong, but of course I have to make sure that I make a correction out of what I have done. Because sometimes there are things we do them and afterwards you learn from them as such.
It depends on the mistake, but most of the time I tend to realize my mistakes, and where it is necessary, I apologize. Why should I keep on moving when I've made a mistake? I've made a mistake, I have to apologize.
When I've done something wrong, I do admit. At the same time, I choose to move forward with my life.
Well, it is hard to admit mistakes, so yeah, usually the first option is to move on and try not to do it again. I think that's my first go-to option.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Thousands of students in Botswana began taking their final exams this week amid concerns over a rise in COVID-19 cases in schools and the impact of disrupted education. Reporter Mkondisi Dube has details from Gaborone.
Dr. Yuan Machi, the UN Children's Fund representative for Botswana, says as many as 90,000 students have been affected by the pandemic. Some are doing their exams in quarantine and isolation centers. This comes after Botswana saw a surge in the number of reported COVID-19 cases in schools. Machi said even after the country lifted its lockdown restrictions in May, some children were struggling to return to class. This week, the COVID-19 Task Force Coordinator, Professor Musibili, said COVID-19 cases in schools have stabilized. However, education sector unions say it's apparent COVID disrupted lessons. The Bofebuso Secretary General, Tabokani Rari, explains.
It also points to issues of floppiness on the side of the Minister of Basic Education. It will then point to the issues of uniformity. There would not be any uniformity. Other students will be taught and others will not be taught. And as a teacher, I think you would not want to deal with such a situation.
Basic Education Permanent Secretary Bridget John said the examinations are progressing well with strict adherence to COVID-19 protocols at examination centers across the country. However, parents like Kaelo Marubing argue COVID-19 has affected learning and examinations should have been postponed.
If you look at it, our children were not able to do extra lessons in preparation for the examinations as some had to go for isolation. This affected their program and will likely affect their results. As we speak, some are still in isolation. It is not an ideal situation.
The World Health Organization has urged the safe reopening of schools in Africa. Most countries opted to reopen exam classes, while in Botswana, all students were back in school after lockdown restrictions were lifted. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habroni, Botswana.
With less than 3 weeks to go before the upcoming presidential elections in U.S., officials across the United States charged with keeping voters safe are taking additional precautions and bracing for possibility that November 3rd and the days that follow could be marred not just by potential cyber attacks, but by violence. International Edition's Lori Lodin asks VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden about what is driving their concerns.
Well, there are a couple of things that are driving these concerns. First, you have the high-profile case in Michigan where the FBI was involved and busted up a plot where some members of an extreme militia were planning to kidnap the governor of Michigan. And the FBI revealed this past week that some of those same plotters were thinking about doing the same, kidnapping the governor of Virginia. So that type of extremism within the U.S., domestic extremism, is something that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have been increasingly concerned about, and they've been increasingly concerned about how that is going to play out, how those extreme views and divisions within the U.S. will play out during the election. In addition, some of the states have been warning that this is dangerous. Specifically, at the end of September, the New Jersey Department of Homeland Security came out with an updated threat assessment that said if there are delays with the election results or with the recounts, that could likely spark protests. And the longer it takes to get official results, the more likely the chances are that there will be some violence, whether it's just lone actors who hold extreme views or whether it's groups that are looking to exploit a prolonged situation. And that's been a real concern from the states because the states themselves have said counting the votes are going to take longer because of all of the mail-in ballots. Some states like Michigan, for example, which says it may not have final results until the Friday after the Tuesday election. So you're talking about 80 or so hours after the polls close. They can't even start counting votes that from mail-in ballots until the morning of the election. So there could be some delayed vote totals. And so with all the and confusion and political division already existing within the country, states are taking the potential for election-related violence very seriously, and they're talking with their law enforcement officers and they're talking with the FBI so they can be prepared on how to handle it should something happen.
How unprecedented is it for the FBI to take such a proactive step or steps like this ahead of a presidential election? We haven't, that I recall in recent years, had this level of concern.
The level of concern is much, much bigger. And it gets back to some of the assessments that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have shared with lawmakers and with the public about the biggest internal threats to the United States. In the past couple of years, and this year in particular, both DHS and the FBI have said the biggest threat to the United States domestically are domestic terrorists, extremist groups within the U.S. And for the most part, they say that while some of that includes radical Islamic terrorists and groups that are inspired, a large component of the threat comes from homegrown groups that are often, in their words, aligned with white supremacist views, radical views here in the U.S., domestic politics. Feeding into those concerns is the knowledge that the FBI and counterintelligence officials have that foreign adversaries, and they say in this case mostly Russia, although other countries are doing it too, have been trying to play on those divisions and feed disinformation and misinformation to increase the political divide, to increase the animosity, increasing the chances that something could happen, that there could be some violence.
Are states being proactive and taking the warnings and concerns seriously? Are they taking actions to to be ready for anything that might come up like this?
Look, some of the boldest, starkest warnings have come from state officials who are taking this threat very, very seriously. One of the first states to talk about it publicly was New Jersey with its updated threat assessment, which talked about various scenarios going from just some protests, spur of the moment protests that turned violent to something much more planned and perhaps much more deadly, to just states talking to the FBI, talking to their law enforcement agencies to make sure that voters who choose to vote and go to the polls on election day can do so without being intimidated, can do so safely. There was a call this week from the National Association of Secretaries of State, and secretaries of state in 40 of the 50 U.S. states are actually in charge of running the elections, which are done in the United States. It's not a national election. The states run the elections themselves, and then all those results go into tallies, and you figure out who won the presidential election. So they have been talking with each other. They have been talking with law enforcement agencies in their own states, but they also say that the FBI, New Mexico, Louisiana, say in particular that they've had outreach from the FBI working with them. The Secretary of State from New Jersey said that they are planning on check-ins on Election Day with law enforcement and the FBI just to make sure things are going smoothly and to be on the lookout for whether it's something on social media or other bits of misinformation, accidentally bad information, or purposefully erroneous disinformation that is out there that could spark something more serious. The states are taking this very seriously. They can call on the National Guard in some cases if they have concerns, but they are getting prepared. They want to have all these possibilities gamed out so they know in the worst case scenario, what do they need to do to bring things under control. Right now, they're confident that they're going to be able to do that.
VOA always delivers your favorite programs, news, music, entertainment, and sports shows. Starting Monday, October 5th, our flagship news show, South Sudan in Focus, will be moving to 1630 UTC, followed by your favorite sports show, The Sunny Side of Sports, at 1700 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Before we end this show, I have a special announcement for you. This program can now be heard in South Sudan at 7:30 local time on VOA affiliate stations. Please inform your friends and relatives. That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now leave you with the song My Country by Lonely Boy from Bidibidi Refugee Camp.
Na na na, we back again. Lonely boy, the master, we back again. And I'm busy kidding.
Junub Sudan,
I am a team.
Junub Sudan,
my country.
Junub Sudan,
Dana Skulum.
Junub Sudan,
and I'm busy kidding.
Junub Sudan,
I am a team.
Junub Sudan,
my country.
Junub Sudan,
Dana Skulum.
Junub Sudan,
and I'm a replay. Nasketil Mabiru to Beleto. Mon Bihaliso. Come on, the city move, Malu. You know Sudan, de beleta masakila po, kebelia fogo. Come on, Zia fogo, me Malis papa. Ita kandrua bi beleta zon, kende ita riza asanta binu. Risala de, kede wasulu le kulu junubin, kede mon hare bele beleta kim. I'm lonely boy, BMC music, oh na na, eh, no no no. And I'm busy kidding,
Junub Sudan,
I am a team,
Junub Sudan,
my country,
Junub Sudan,
Dana Skulum,
Junub Sudan,
and I'm busy kidding,
Junub Sudan,
I am a team,
Junub Sudan,
my country,
Junub Sudan,
Dana Skulum,
Junub Sudan. Pulek bak duduke
aina
dolong bak aduke
aina
dog bak yeye junyo
aina na
nandi pondi duke
aina na
ledi sepa madi
aina na
ledi sepa kakwa
aina na
ledi sepa kuku
aina na
lakindo popuru.
We've been listening to Lonely Boy from Bidibidi Refugee Camp in Uganda with the song My Country. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, vehicles, and phones. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
domokanyo, domokanyo, dorenya ni julet.